And the views and opinions expressed on Gaza Corner are those of me, Dori Stein, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of KALW, a public media. And I'm pleased for tonight's Gaza Corner to include a very important voice from Jerusalem, and that is Gerard Horton of Military Court Watch. Gerard, hello there.
Hi, good to be here.
I hope you've had your breakfast, or you're eating it now.
I've had my breakfast, yeah.
Okay. Well, Military Court Watch monitors the treatment of children in Israeli military detention and does far more than that. I'm sure right now things have perhaps, at least in the last 20 years or so, never been more extreme, and your work never has been more important. Tell me where you'd like to start. There's so many places we can go, but I'll let you have free rein.
Thanks very much. Well, I guess just to sort of give a broad overview of our work. So what we are is an organization made up of mainly lawyers from Palestine, Israel, Europe, North America, and Australia. And we just monitor one issue, the arrest, detention, prosecution of Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in Israeli military courts. And just last week, we issued a report which basically reviews all the evidence we've collected since January 2013. And you know, some of the observations from that evidence, I think, could possibly be interesting. I think the standout takeaway point from a lot of this evidence is just where the children live who get arrested in the West Bank. Based on over 1,100 testimonies we've collected from children detained in the West Bank since 2013, our evidence shows that about 98% of them live within several kilometers of an illegal Israeli settlement or a road used by settlers. And that's not a coincidence. If you move 500,000 Israeli civilians into the occupied West Bank in contravention of international law, doesn't include the settlers in East Jerusalem, you will need a very heavy military presence to support that project. And so what happens is the Palestinians who live in villages, refugee camps, towns in close proximity to those settlements in the West Bank come in contact with that military presence, leads to friction, protests, clashes, and inevitably arrests. And that's the reason the overwhelming majority of these children end up in military detention.
Now, are most of them arrested in night raids or actually committing a crime, or are most of the children not even charged?
So what happens is, so most of the children end up eventually being charged. Our evidence shows that in the last 11 years, 55% of the children who were arrested are detained in military raids on their homes in the middle of the night. So there was a recent UN report which refers to the period prior to the 7th of October. Obviously, things have intensified significantly since 7th of October. But what that evidence, that UN report shows is that currently, prior to the 7th of October, the Israeli military in the West Bank were conducting 3,000 night operations in the West Bank each year, which works out at about a bit over 8 night operations each and every night in the West Bank. Now, most of those operations occur in these friction points, in these Palestinian villages, refugee camps, towns, in close proximity to settlements. So when we go to these communities, people often say to us that their houses have been raided not just once, but multiple times. It's important to note, too, that during these military operations at night in the West Bank, they're not simply to arrest people. Sometimes, in many cases, arrests do occur, but sometimes it's just a process of going into the villages, banging on doors, searching houses. No one is arrested. It's what the Israeli military often refers to as making their presence felt. And what that means is that if you live in a Palestinian village or refugee camp close to an Israeli settlement, like I said before, there's inevitable friction. When friction occurs, the number one tool the Israeli military has to restore calm is to subject that village to constant night raids. So night after night after night, the military will go into those locations. Like I said, sometimes they arrest people, sometimes not. So there was one village we monitored north of Ramallah. And in 1 month, that village was raided 16 times in 1 month. So every second night, the army was in that village searching, making their presence felt. As you can imagine, these are extremely traumatizing experiences for the people who live in these villages. I was reading a testimony from a former Israeli soldier the other day, and he was saying that every time they go into these villages and make everyone get out of bed, go to the living room, he said almost invariably the younger children will wet themselves. You know, that's how traumatizing these can be. And in that village north of Ramallah, where the military came in 16 times in just 1 month, only on one occasion was someone arrested. So it's you know, sometimes it's about arresting people. Other times it's just making their presence felt. And the idea behind that is to try and stamp out any form of protest. You know, and that can be a spectrum. It can be from stamp out any form of peaceful protest, which is illegal, right up to violent acts. And the reason they need to do that is to ensure that the Israeli civilians living in the illegal settlement next door can go about their daily lives in occupied territory as though they were living in Tel Aviv. That is the harsh reality of building settlements in occupied territory, is you will have to subject the local population to constant military presence with all that entails. So our evidence, as I said, collected over the last 11 years has shown that 55% of children are detained in these military raids. They usually occur about anywhere between about midnight and 5 o'clock in the morning. Most seem to occur at around 2 o'clock. It will begin with aggressive banging at the front door. If you don't open up the front door quickly, it's simply blown off its hinges. Everyone will be then gathered in the living room, typically, regardless of age, whether it's a grandparent or a grandchild. And like I said, it can be extremely traumatizing. If someone is to be arrested, no arrest warrants are required to arrest Palestinians in the West Bank. Which is very unlikely, but if a Israeli settler were to be arrested, and they wouldn't be arrested by the army, they'd be arrested by the police, that's not going to occur at night, and an arrest warrant would be required. For a Palestinian, no arrest warrant is required. So in most cases, there's simply no paperwork. There are no reasons given. In circumstances where reasons are given or some documents are provided, it's very minimal. It's simply a list of interrogation centers, telephone numbers, and the officer in command typically will just circle the interrogation center that person, whether it's a child or adult, will be taken to. What we found from our evidence is that in the few cases where this document is provided to the parents, when they call that number, no one ever picks up the phone. So it's more form over substance. Sometimes houses are searched, sometimes damage is done to the contents of the house. And then the child or adult, whoever has been arrested, will be blindfolded and zip tied and taken away. The zip ties the military use are those plastic zip ties. You're probably familiar with them. The problem with these zip ties is if you put them on quickly, it's very easy to over-tighten them. We get a lot of complaints that the ties are too tight. Sometimes they restrict blood flow to the wrists. Sometimes they cut into the wrists. The reason that happens, more often than not, it's if you're a 19-year-old conscript from Tel Aviv in the middle of the West Bank at 2 o'clock in the morning, you want to get out of there as quickly as possible. And so they're putting these ties on quickly. But the consequence of that is it can cause significant harm.
That's the voice of Gerard Horton of Military Court Watch. It's militarycourtwatch.org is the website. And Gerard, you're explaining something the same way you would have explained it 10 years ago. So I think it's important for listeners to understand that this was happening way before October 7th. What you're describing is just the status quo. This is the way it's always been. Since October 7th, there has been an incredible spike in what was already, I think it's fair to say, a systemic use of mass incarceration of children, but now far more. In fact, I think the number I read was something like there were 5,000 Palestinians in prison. I don't know exactly the percentage that are children, but substantial. And since then, at least 3,000 more Palestinians have been, I would use the word kidnapped. I wouldn't just use the word arrested. Some of it is just arbitrary detention. That's the actual phrase that the UN has been using. And the conditions which you've documented in your report at Military Court Watch, the conditions are now markedly worse than they were prior to October 7th. Can you talk about the conditions of detention and also the use of torture?
Yeah, so what, as you say, just prior to October the 7th, the official date was just under 5,000 men, women, and children were detained, of which 156 were children aged 12 to 17. Then what happened after October the 7th is pretty much the same system, but just, if I can put it this way, turbocharged. So as you said, the figures I've seen, unofficial figures, is an additional 3,500 or so have been detained, men, women, and children. The impact of that obviously is overcrowding of the prison. So like in any prison system, you have regulations as to how many prisoners you can put in a cell, how much space each prisoner is entitled to. Those regulations have been suspended by the Knesset. So whereas you might have 6 people in a cell, now you might have 12. So there's significant overcrowding. The prisons are in lockdown. What that means is no family visits, no telephone communication, no radio, no television. So the prisoners are completely in the dark as to what's going on. Limited access to their lawyers. Reports from those that have been released since October the 7th suggest that the quality of food, the amount of food has been significantly reduced. There's also a good many reports of violence occurring. Sounds, in some respects, these are just from testimonial reports we've received. In some respects, it sounds like it's almost simply revengeful sort of violence, like guards will come into the cell and just beat people up for no reason as a result of what happened on October the 7th. But I should add, and you pointed this out, that this is just part of a long system that has been going on since 1967. It goes in peaks and troughs of severity, but it's very much the same system. And it's about controlling the Palestinian population in the West Bank, as I said, so that the settlers living there illegally can live, you know, a normal life as one can in occupied territory. And so part of that has always been a good degree of ill treatment, some of it amounting to torture. So in the report we just released, historically, our evidence showed that about 2% of children were subjected to solitary confinement as part of their interrogation process. And this is very harsh. I mean, studies have been done everywhere about the impact of solitary confinement, particularly on children. But this was of a particularly harsh variety. So, for example, the cells you'd be put in were not much larger than your body length, no windows frequently, lights left on 24 hours a day, so you don't know if it's day or night. And you're just taken from that cell to the interrogation room. The only person you meet is the interrogator. And the average length of time was about 14 days, the longest about 45 days. And anyone who knows anything about solitary confinement knows that it has the potential to psychologically destroy you.
There was you probably will know his name because I can't place it, but he was like 13 years old, and his brother was killed in a knife attack of an Israeli who was injured. The 13-year-old who was not involved in the knife attack was arrested, and he had been in some form or another of solitary confinement for years.
Yeah, that's unusual. That was in East Jerusalem. That's actually under the Israeli civilian legal system. His solitary confinement was also part of his, after he'd been convicted in his detention. No, that's just as bad as any other form of solitary confinement. Under the military legal system, what we're specifically talking about here is solitary confinement used as part of the interrogation process. And what it does is it destroys your ability to resist interrogation. And what people frequently say is they will say and do anything to get out of solitary confinement. And that's generally what we see. People will confess. They will confess on anyone in the village. The interrogator wants them to. And it's also easy to recruit the person as a collaborator. So that was the historical situation. What we found in 2019 is it went from 2% up to about 8%. In 2020, it went from 8% to 17%. And then in 2021, it jumped to 42%. So nearly half of the children in 2021 were being placed in solitary confinement. We haven't completed collecting evidence for 2022 yet, but it's still at 28%. And like I said, children engage in self-harm, suicide attempts, having been placed in solitary confinement. And this is, bear in mind, this is all prior to the 7th of October. It is the nature of the system. Technically, the legal definition of arbitrary, much of this would fall within the legal definition of arbitrary detention. But I should point out, on a sort of non-legal definition, in some ways, I would not necessarily describe this as arbitrary detention in terms of for no reason whatsoever. The reason I say that is, again, it goes back to the settlements. If you are going to put 500,000 Israeli civilians into occupied territory, you will by necessity have to identify anyone you perceive as a troublemaker, anyone with leadership material, anything that might pose as an opposition to that settlement project in the villages and refugee camps in the surrounding locations. And you'll need to identify those people and detain those people. So, for example, a common example will be a military convoy will go into one of these villages just to stir everyone up. What we often find is almost inevitably, if a military convoy goes into a Palestinian village, young people will come out and throw stones at them. What frequently happens is some young people will throw stones at the military convoy and then run away. There are a lot of other young people there who are just there to see what's going on. They often don't run away because they haven't done anything wrong. And they're often the ones that get arrested. It's a very chaotic scene. It's easy to make mistakes. Sometimes it's not a mistake. Sometimes it's like, why run across town to catch a boy running fast when there's a boy right next to you you can arrest? And so in a sense, that's arbitrary. But in another sense, it's about collective punishment. It's about making sure that the village collectively understands that any form of resistance, whether it's violent or peaceful, will not be tolerated. So, like I said, the settlers can go about their daily business next door. And so there is, it's not just totally random. There is reason and a thought process behind this system.
Gerard, it's also important to emphasize that these settlements are intentionally built so close to Palestinian villages and communities that they are fomenting this friction intentionally so that they can intimidate the population, maybe even push them off their land, certainly arrest a disproportionate amount of children. And this is all part of the formula.
Yeah, and I think we have to remember that these settlements are built in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. What's an interesting feature, a legal feature of this whole system too, is when these military courts were set up on the 7th of June, 1967, in which Palestinian civilians are prosecuted, including children, Israel was entitled to set up military courts on the 7th of June, 1967, temporarily. But what's interesting is the order that set up the courts relied on the Fourth Geneva Convention as the legal basis upon which Israel was acting. The same convention that prohibits settlement construction in occupied territory. So you don't need to be a lawyer to understand how damaging this is to the rules-based order, that a party to the Fourth Geneva Convention will essentially pick and choose which rules they'll abide by and which ones they won't. So when it comes to prosecuting Palestinians in military courts, Israel is in favor of the Fourth Geneva Convention. When it comes to building settlements in the occupied territory, Israel rejects the application of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And I think that highlights the bigger danger of this conflict. You know, assuming you're not Palestinian, you're not Israeli, possibly if you're not Jewish, you know, what's this to you? One aspect of it is that its ability to just destroy the legal framework that we established at the end of the Second World War. Principles such as not transferring civilians into occupied territory or removing them, settlement construction in occupied territory, annexation of territory. Another aspect of transferring civilians, which I haven't touched on yet, is the fact that the children who do go through this system, the military detention system, and the adults, since 1967, around 70% of them have been unlawfully transferred out of the West Bank to prisons inside Israel. So just like international law prohibits Israel moving its civilians into occupied territory, it prohibits the removal of civilians from occupied territory, even if they're detainees. Now, that's been going on since 1967. The data comes from the Israeli Prison Service. It has affected up to about 32,000 children during that period of time, and around 600,000 adults during that period of time. It's on a massive scale. Now, what's interesting is that earlier this year, Vladimir Putin and one other were arrest warrants were issued by the International Criminal Court for the same offense, for transferring children from occupied Ukraine to the Russian Federation. It took the International Criminal Court less than 18 months to issue arrest warrants for Russians involved in that transfer. It's been going on here since 1967 and affecting enormous numbers of individuals. So far, no action has been taken. And I think that just highlights the point that we will ultimately destroy the rules-based order if we simply apply it to our strategic adversaries like Russia. And if we turn a blind eye to our strategic friends like Israel, it's understandable based on an interest-based world order, but it's not a rules-based order. And we do run the risk of simply destroying these rules that were put in place as a result of what happened in the Second World War.
Well, I would argue that it's pretty much destroyed already. International Criminal Court has only arrested criminals from the Global South, with the exception of Slobodan Milosevic. International human rights law is ignored. The UN is impotent. And it's really hard to do anything with the UN when, you know, the United States can be the sole country in the world to veto a ceasefire, and then there's no ceasefire.
You know, which will make us the generation that loses the peace.
Yeah, and I should mention that at militarycourtwatch.org, and we're talking to Gerard Horton of Military Court Watch, if you go to the homepage, what Gerard is talking about is a opinion piece that's right on the homepage, so you could really delve into it. It's called No Rules, No Order. Just open up that link on the homepage, and more details will appear. And also at the Tangents, and also at the Military Court Watch website, but also at the Tangents playlist, is a link to the November 29th report titled The Systemic Torture and or ill treatment of protected persons, parenthetically children, and their unlawful transfer from occupied territory. Impunity is really what governs Israeli actions, whether it be through incarceration, through bombing, through forced population transfer, through stealing Palestinian land. It's not held, you know, it's not held to account. And I really think it's admirable that you keep such incredibly detailed documentation, and other organizations do as well, although you're fighting such an uphill battle. And I saw a tweet that mentioned a Palestinian prisoner who had been raped, 13 years old. And it was a tweet from Mohammed Shahada, who I think is a journalist. And it was brought to attention from DCIP, what's it stand for? Defense for Children International Palestine. And that organization documented this rape. And then the very next day, Israel raided their office. It's an NGO, raided the office and declared it a terrorist organization. And that's how Israel reacts to being documented. Are you familiar with that story?
Yes, I heard something. I think there was some report on CNN the other day. Yeah, I mean, what we as an organization focus on particularly is in this report, there's over 1,100 cases. We tend to really focus on the run-of-the-mill cases, the day-to-day cases. Like, sexual violence is pretty rare, I have to say. But there's so much about this system that happens day in, day out. The arresting in the middle of the night, the denial of legal, like even under Israeli military law, you have rights. You have the right to consult with a lawyer, the right to silence, systematically ignored in the overwhelming majority of cases. So we really, as an organizer, we really focus on the thousands of cases. We tend not to highlight, you know, every so often we'll get one extremely outlier type case. Now, it's important to document it, but what we're keen to do is just to show what is the impact on the overwhelming majority of children, because this is very, like I said, this is very systematic, it's very policy driven, and it's very focused in its objective to ensure, you know, this is essentially what's going on in the West Bank is de facto annexation, allowing Israeli civilians to move into occupied territory and carry on as if they're living in sovereign Israel.
I read a report that the children who were released from Israeli detention during the 7-day humanitarian pause, those children who lived in East Jerusalem are not being allowed to return to school.
What we've particularly heard from everyone we've spoken to is all of the people, it seems, all of the detainees who were released as part of that exchange, they and their families have all been threatened not to speak to the media, not to speak to NGOs. One mother told us that in some cases they're threatened just before they were threatened just before they left prison. In other cases, Israeli intelligence officers would phone the parents and threaten the parents. One of the threats was you'll be fined 70,000 shekels if you speak to the media.
Which is how much money is that?
So divide approximately by, so it's probably around in the order of about $20,000. They're about $15,000 to $20,000, which obviously if you live in a refugee camp is a fortune. And so, yeah, a real campaign of intimidation, so that, you know, these stories of abuse in prison, etc., you know, the idea being they don't come out.
Well, we've run out of time, but do you have any closing thoughts that maybe we didn't get to that you want to share?
Just, I think I would just, obviously the details of the individual cases are shocking, but I think As Americans or foreigners, we have to always keep in mind that we are losing the system of law that we put in place at the end of the Second World War. How are we supposed to deal with China, with Russia, other challenges that face us on the grounding of the rule of law, if then we've just abandoned it when it comes to Israel? We have to be consistent or we don't have a rules-based order.
Thank you, Gerard. Gerard Horton of Military Court Watch, the website militarycourtwatch.org. Thank you for talking to us this early morning from Jerusalem. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks very much for the invitation.